crime prevention expert, retired Fairfield Police Lieutenant Jim Perez, with Crime on the Mind. Exclusively on Melissa in the Morning, WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
We are talking about wrong way drivers because we've continued to see a real issue here in Connecticut since the pandemic, but certainly 2022, record numbers in our state of wrong-way crashes. 2023 wasn't much better, and 2024 not off to a great start after this past weekend where four people passed away in a wrong-way driving incident on I-95, two others fighting for their lives in the hospital. So Jim Perez is here to talk about the technology that's been rolling out in recent years in Connecticut to try and stop this issue and whether or not it's working. Hey, Jim, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Interestingly enough, you recently had a meeting, in Newington? Because they rolled out some of this new technology recently.
Well, no, recently I just finished having what's called research training. So it's recertification training. So every 3 years you have to have a certain amount of training in order to maintain your certification as a police officer. And one of the days, a whole day, was pretty much concentrating on just crashes and what the Department of Transportation in Newington is doing and things like that. And, you know, it's really a somber day because during this training you get to see just horrific death and crashes and incidences. But it's all part of police training, right? So it's kind of like what you have to go through. But one of the things I did get out of it that's excellent is, and we've talked about this in the past where we've talked about, you know, the need for something to be done with wrong-way drivers. Well, now the state has gone into action, and they have a what's called a wrong-way driver countermeasure program, where they're actually installing bright lights in wrong-way in exits, so that people coming the opposite way will be warned adequately enough so they can turn around and go back the other way before someone gets hurt or injured or killed.
Right. So that's something that they've only really rolled that out, it seems like, in some municipalities, certainly not across the state, because it costs money and they want to see if it works. But it what you're saying, Jim, is it sounds like it is showing it's working. People are actively seeing it and they're turning around.
Right. In Connecticut, let's just say back in 2022, right, there were 13 wrong-way crashes that ended up in 23 fatalities. And in 2023, preliminary data, which, you know, they don't have it fully yet, show that, you know, there were 7 fatalities. So these things are happening. And I think that after dark, people need to kind of be aware, super aware of their surroundings, because a one-way driver driving in the opposite direction at an average speed of between 50 and 70 can be devastating, because the accident or the crash will catch you by surprise or happen quickly. So you have to be careful.
Yeah, you definitely do. And again, we have Jim Perez here, who is our crime prevention expert on WICC and host of Crime on the Mind. And a question we got actually after this recent incident in West Haven from a listener, Jim, was how do you avoid them? So let's say you're not the wrong way driver. You're the one who's on the highway and you see those lights coming and you know that they're coming your way and that you want to, in some way, shape or form, avoid the chaos. First of all, is that even possible? And if so, what do you recommend?
Well, first of all, if these things happen, they're going to happen quickly. But just understand, let's just look at the mind frame of an individual that's intoxicated or not in their right mind. Mm. So one of the things they're going to do is they're going to get on the wrong way. And then immediately they're going to say to themselves, you know, maybe I should be in the slow lane. So chances are that they're going to go onto the off or on the off ramp. Mm-hmm. Then they're going to go onto the highway. Then they're going to immediately cross lanes all the way over to the fast lane.
So what you're saying is even if you're in the slow lane, that might not actually be the safest spot, or I don't know. What do you recommend?
So what I'm saying is that I would, if I'm traveling at night, mm-hmm. I would try to avoid the extreme left lane or lane number one, the extreme left lane. So lanes are named differently. The fastest lane is 1, the middle lane is 2, and then the right lane or the slow lane is 3.
Okay.
So I would avoid the fastest lane, and I would stay in the middle, because that would probably give you the best chances of reacting if you see headlights coming at you. Mm-hmm. But one of the first things you can do if you do see headlights coming at you is put your flashers on and immediately go to the slowest lane.
Okay.
And if you can get off on it, and if you can get off, and if there's a medium where you could actually get completely off the road, I would do that.
Here's another thing I was thinking, Jim, as you talk about flashers, because mm-hmm. I've seen this before. Not too often, because I don't drive late at night anymore because I'm too scared, honestly, of wrong-way drivers. Also, I'm in bed by 7 o'clock because I'm a weirdo and I work and whatever.
Well, yeah, of course.
What about people who just leave their flashers on? I don't know if they're doing it because they actually are. Like, I've literally seen people who just leave their flashers on when you're driving at, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning.
That's not a good idea, because leaving them on all the time will be very distracting for other drivers around you.
Got it. So,
and it makes no sense. Flashers are meant to be put on to warn others that you are there. And it's usually when you're stuck or you're immobile, you can't move the vehicle. Mm-hmm. However, I think in a time where you have a wrong way driver, and let's say you have enough space, and we're talking thousands of feet, where you actually see the headlights coming towards you.
Right.
I would just simply put the flashes on and move to the extreme right lane or the slowest lane. Or what I would do is I would actually, get off the medium. Like, in other words, get off the highway completely if I could.
I was just going to say, would you pull off to the side?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I would. I would, because you never know where that car is going. And let me tell you something, when that car travels fast, it can happen really, really quick. I don't think most people will have that opportunity, unfortunately, because of the curves, the curvatures, and the geographical, just the way the landscape is. But I think that one smart habit is to not drive in the fastest lane, is to be in the middle or in the right lane, because I think you'll have more opportunities to react, especially
and
from
to get
the middle
off safely.
You can go to the right or to the left, but more importantly, if you have enough grass off to the side or enough area, I would just kind of do that until that car passes, and then I would call 911. But I got to tell you, DOT is promising, the program that they have is very promising. The governor did sign it into not law, but policy. Mm-hmm. So right now they're looking at 15 locations across Connecticut in which they've actually used these. You have to understand something, there's about 200, almost 240 freeway exit ramps in Connecticut.
Right. Yeah, so, there's a lot. It's a lot to cover.
Yeah,
but if we're already seeing success with a couple.
There's more than that. But
right
now the project, which is called 017-3608, is a project that the state is putting into effect. And DOT has been showed us this past week how promising it is. We actually saw live feed video of cars going on the wrong way, and then once these bright lights hit them, they realize the mistake and they turn around, because no one wants to do this on purpose.
No. We are doing Crime on the Mind with Lieutenant Jim Perez, retired Lieutenant Perez, who we do Crime on the Mind with every week, and we're talking about wrong way crashes, wrong way drivers, and we were just talking about some new technology that has rolled out in only a couple of municipalities, because first of all, it's very expensive. Second of all, we have to see if it works. And it does seem like in some of the towns where it is working. Jim had mentioned that he saw surveillance footage of drivers literally seeing the flashing lights and actively turning around. I think he said there was one driver who did not, but it's because he purposely was going to help a disabled vehicle. Here's my question though, Jim. Do we know if any of those drivers who actively turned around were drunk? Because the one question I keep asking the DOT or AAA or state police is that if the majority of our wrong way crashes in Connecticut stem from people being impaired, do the flashing lights and the signage, does any of that matter?
Well, here's what it is. I mean, and let's just be realistic, right? We cannot possibly have a state trooper or a municipal officer at every single exit.
Yeah.
It's just possible. However, what's incorporated into the countermeasures program is that immediately when that happens, the local state police bureau is notified as well as DOT.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might say, well, who cares about DOT being on there? Well, DOT is important because they have eyes on all camera locations throughout the entire state. And believe it or not, they help out a lot of local municipalities because they can immediately go onto that camera if the highway crosses, through that town, and they can immediately assist that way. So it's really quite a an impressive program that they have, number one. But number two, the notification of state police is important because then the troopers can immediately dispatch to that area and try and find that car. But to answer your question, is it a silver bullet? No. Can we always get them? No. But I could give you an idea of where some of the programs are happening or where they're at now if people wanted to kind of, you know, drive by and not go on it, but see.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Where are they installed right now?
Well, most of them are in the northern part of the state. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about North Haven, Plainville, Southbury, Derby, Rocky Hill, East Hartford, Hartford, New Haven, Stonington, Southbury, kind of like, you know, East Hartford in those areas. And so hopefully the plan is to get them everywhere, right? That would be the ideal thing. But it is very costly, it is time consuming, and the state is doing whatever they can to try and get everything done as expeditiously and safely as possible. And this is going to be, you know, this is going to take time, you know, is the bottom line. It's not going to be overnight, but as they continually see successes, and the DOT is the one that's monitoring these things, they're going to continue to roll them out. And my wish would be that they would be at every exit.
Yeah, I mean, that would be amazing, certainly. And I know that there's, you know, efforts on a lot of different fronts. We were talking about how manufacturers for automakers, they're thinking for future cars, you know, even having in-car breathalyzers where it wouldn't go to cops or anything like that. You wouldn't get in trouble, but the car won't start if you are above the legal limit. I know that there are a lot of conversations about stopping this issue in some capacity, but we know Connecticut is certainly on top of it and trying to do its part. And certainly talking about it here on a radio station and bringing awareness to it, that also does play a role in trying to stop the issue.
Going the car manufacturer route is tough because these are entrenched institutions that don't like to really change, or any change they make can pretty much be non-cost effective, but that's not an excuse, but I think that going to technology the way the state is going now is actually the right way, and I commend the governor and everyone in DOT for doing this because I think they actually help save lives. And none of us will really know how many lives we actually help to save,
you know,
but that's not the important part. The important part is the lives are being saved.
Exactly.
I think that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think it's driver responsibility at the end of the day. You know, the people who get behind the wheel, if you are tired, if you are impaired, if you are, you know, I think there, unfortunately, you could do as much as we can. And I know Connecticut's going to keep doing that. And I think that's great. But at some point, you know, it also comes down to driver responsibility and holding yourselves accountable. I don't know. So it's a tough one for sure. But Jim, I really appreciate you sharing your insight and what you've been certainly gathering, you know, from other entities in the state. I really appreciate that and for weighing in on the conversation.
Sure, absolutely. Have a great week.
Thank you. You too. And I do know we've been getting some calls since Jim came on the show, and we've been talking about wrong way crashes in the state and concerns people have, questions people have. Why are we seeing more and more in recent years? We will take more of your calls, actually. If you were listening to my news late last week, you probably heard this news headline. Lawmakers in Connecticut right now are considering a proposal to bolster law enforcement efforts. They want to introduce license plate readers across cities and towns all over Connecticut. So under this proposed legislation, cities and towns would have the opportunity to apply for funding so they could integrate more of these readers into law enforcement infrastructure. But we're not just talking about mounting the cameras on police cruisers. They could also be strategically placed along roadways. And so I wanted to talk about the impact of these license plate readers, why the state would be focusing on something like this, and who better to talk to than somebody who is knee deep in law enforcement and has been for many years. Gary McNamara is somebody we go to a lot with these major stories here and across the country. And he is somebody who is, again, has a lot of experience in law enforcement. He was the former chief of police in Fairfield, and he now is the chief and executive director of public safety and government affairs at Sacred Heart University. But he also sits on many boards with the state and really is an advocate for bolstering law enforcement. So I thought he'd be the perfect person to talk to about this. Hey, Gary, welcome back. How are you?
Hello, Melissa. Thanks for having me. And I'm so glad you're talking about that wrong way crash. I know we spoke about it in the past, and It's just those accidents are so unforgiving, and it is evident with the, you know, with the four fatalities.
It's horrible.
So glad we're still talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Have to. We have to, Gary. It's really so devastating. And I know a lot of people, including even in our own household, we've had to change the rules of driving, unless it's something where we have to drive late at night. And even then, we both have to be, I was giving the example of when we drove back from the Bruins game weeks ago. Obviously, we were driving back late at night. And so we have a routine where when this does happen, one of us drives. It's usually my husband. And the other person in the passenger seat has to have like an energy drink, basically, so that we are awake and alert and can be like a second pair of eyes, because I'm terrified of wrong way drivers. It's just, it's horrific. So anyways, yes, we will keep talking about it. Certainly. This is also another big talker. We had this in our news last week and a lot of people seemed in support of it, but I thought we'd do a deeper dive and really get law enforcement perspective on this. First of all, let's talk about license plate readers and why they make such an impact for law enforcement.
So, you know, traditionally, or when I first came on the job, you know, obviously vehicles have license plates. And in order for police to get information long ago, you'd have to call in on the radio to dispatch, and dispatch would be able to access a computer to find out information about the vehicle. With technology ever increasing, it started with license plate readers on cars, and a lot of departments use them for big parking lots to do traffic enforcement. But the technology will now allow an officer's camera to not only locate the license plate on the vehicle, but also can kick back information on it, specifically the information that we all want the cops to know about.
Like
so
what?
So in other words, if it's a stolen car, if it's wanted in connection with a felony, I mean, you can go on and on with any of the things that we do, any silver alert, any amber alert where we're looking for a vehicle. Now, a series of license plate readers strategically placed wherever may be able to pick up a vehicle that we're looking for. So it enhances the officer's ability to get information quickly. They'll always have the ability to get the information. So it's not necessarily changing the officer's access to our information. It's just giving them a more efficient and effective way to do it.
And you sort of answered my second question, Gary, which is what have we seen in recent years that would call for something like this? Like, why now pass a piece of legislation like this for police?
Well, first of all, they've been out there for a while. If you drive into Manhattan, you've got to assume once you cross into Manhattan, you're on license plate readers and cameras all the time. So I know there is a concern about privacy, but that kind of ship has sailed, not only with regards to the cameras that maybe law enforcement uses, but, you know, during a day, you're caught on camera hundreds of times, all of us, from banks to any place that we enter. But the ability to quickly put information, you know, one of the things we look for is we have to find the bad people. We have to find the stolen cars. It's hard to put police officers everywhere to find them. So cameras can alert officers whether or not a stolen car is entering or exiting a location, whether or not a car wanted in a felony for a bank robbery just drove down the post road in a various town. So it allows that information to get there. And Amber Alert's the best one for it. You know, we get those alerts, look for this license plate. Well, that information is entered into the computer system, and these license plate readers can pick that information up to say that vehicle was just seen here, potentially seen here.
Boom. I mean, you just answered the question perfectly. And again, we have Gary McNamara here, who's one of our law enforcement experts on the show. And I think of the story out of Ansonia and the little girl who's still missing there, Vanessa.
Sure.
And I think about the fact that, man, what precious time between the time that her mother was found murdered, when the actual crime was committed and Vanessa disappeared, to when police showed up at the scene and realized what they were dealing with. Those were precious hours that, of course, they didn't know until they got there. But, man, a reader would have been super helpful if we had them in every town and city across Connecticut and we knew where that car was going. I mean, and again, doesn't mean it's going to solve every case, but I do think that it, especially when we saw the police accountability law go into place, and I know police across the board felt like it was really taking away a lot of the rights of police and making it harder for them to do their jobs, like police chases and things like that. this has to be a tool, I would think, in their back pocket.
Well, it does. And so look at the example of gas stations recently being broken into in a series of communities. So if the Glastonbury Police Department responds to a broken gas station, you know, somebody entered, and they get a license plate, then they can put that into the system as a car wanted and a felony. And then that is in there. So now in Hartford, if that car is seen driving there or it makes its way down to the coast in Guilford or somewhere, those if those license plate readers are there, it will be able to pick up that car and say, hey, Guilford, a car just involved in a crime here is now in your community. So it starts to allow you to prepare for that, and you can backtrack it. So my daughter is missing. The police respond. I say, I think she's been abducted, and here's the license plate. You can put that information in, and then you can have departments search to see whether or not that license plate, before they even knew it, was in their town. So then you start to get a roadmap of where those vehicles may have been. So, you know, suicidal people who leave in a car, they're very distraught. I don't know where they went. There's the potential for all those license plate readers to pick up cars. Cops aren't going to know every license plate that's of interest to them. You know, this person's missing. This person's upset. This person might have abducted a child. This one might be involved in a felony. So to have that overlay within the camera system, the information already exists in systems. The difference is police officers have to call out license plates and continually do that or be aware of it. These cameras mounted will just pick up license plates that are of interest to law enforcement and alert them that they're in the area.
We're chatting with Gary McNamara, one of our law enforcement experts on the show. He is currently the Chief and Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart. He also was the former Chief of Police in Fairfield. He's on a lot of boards here in the state and is somebody who weighs in on a lot of law enforcement topics for Connecticut and right here on WICC. We appreciate him. So we're talking about this piece of legislation being discussed up in Hartford during the session right now, and it would introduce license plate readers across cities and towns in Connecticut, and it would give the opportunity for municipalities to get funding so that they could integrate license plate readers, not just mounted on police cruisers, but even strategically placed along roadways. You sort of hinted at it before, Gary. I would imagine the only opposition to this would be privacy. And maybe I'm thinking too elementary about this, but much like I say to my son, if you're not doing anything wrong, then there's no reason to get upset about it. I don't know if that's sort of the mentality of law enforcement, but I don't even know if this is an invasion of privacy when you talk about traveling anywhere. We're constantly, I feel like, on camera. Our cars are, not so much what's happening in our cars, but the actual vehicles, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I'm flying out of LaGuardia tomorrow, and I'm registered in the parking space, and it's by my license plate. So when I pull in, the license plate reader is going to pick that up and say that I'm here. I think the issue becomes for people is if they're in a location where they don't think they should be. They're not doing a criminal matter, but they're fearful they're going to be caught on camera going places where no one has a right to know, and now it's documented. So there is those, you know, people have their own individual concerns about Big Brother and what all that data can do. I know the data expires, but I think that's really the only issue with it. But you have to remember, Melissa, staffing of police is low. Police cannot be everywhere. And we need to utilize technology to continue to make our community safer. And that's really the goal of this. You know, it can be used very proactively as well. So let's say a crime happens, a murder happens, and the police have no leads. They can check various computers around the area or the cameras around the area and find out what vehicles left the area shortly before they arrive. And maybe that would be the lead that could rescue an abducted child, that could solve a murder or a homicide for a family. So there are always going to be those discussions of privacy when it comes to law enforcement technology. We can't hide from it. We have to talk about it. Mm-hmm. There has to be reassurances. But, you know, privacy matters. But at the same time, the only way we have privacy is if our communities are safe. And so this technology will certainly enhance police officers' ability to do that.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, but police are not really allowed to actively pursue a car. Like if you have a stolen vehicle, I mean, our police can't really have a chase through town, right? I mean, what are they sort of allowed to do? Because I would think this technology would be helpful in that regard, too.
Yeah, well, so the law has changed with regards to police pursuits because and they really have to involve a crime of violence, a significant crime of violence for police to pursue. They're not allowed to pursue for property crimes. That is a whole nother debate, whether or not that is leading to the rise in stolen cars and larcenies because people aren't fearful. But yeah, as it sits right now, they can't pursue. So if you can't pursue these vehicles, at least you can track them via some technology
and
maybe find out where they are. Exactly.
That's what I'm getting at.
Enhanced.
I mean,
that's right.
When you look at, Gary, what we've been going through the last few years, whether or not it has to do with law changes, COVID, whatever, we're living in what we're living in. I think that's the big thing. Is we could go back and forth and go blue in the face if we want to, arguing about how we got to this point. Not you and me, but I'm saying as a society. But the issue is we're here. Here we are. So what do we do when we have those catalytic converter thefts? What do we do when somebody is a slider, gets into your car at a gas station and takes off with your car while you're pumping gas on the other side? What do you do when the kid is sitting in the back seat and your car was just taken? What do you do when your car was parked at a mall and someone goes in and takes your property while you were away? You know, these are all things that are happening way more often and even during the light of day. And so we have to be able to respond. And I think if we aren't allowing cops to pursue that right now, we need to give them another option.
That's right. That's right. And this will be helpful in solving some of those that you talked about. You know, abducted. I leave my car, my keys running in the gas station, which you shouldn't do, but you do. My kid's in the back seat. I come out, my car's gone. You call the police, and they can instantly put out that web and search those cameras to see where that car might have gone.
Exactly.
And so I'm happy the state is not only encouraging it, but they're also funding it. That's the big change right here. Oh, departments have been doing this and putting them strategically in areas. Now the state's coming in to say, we see their effectiveness. We know staffing of police are low. Technology can help make our community safer. So we're not only going to encourage it, we're also going to have some funding behind it.
Yeah, and hopefully this passes. We'll certainly see what happens with the legislative session and with this proposal in particular. And Gary, thank you so much for giving us your professional insight on this. I think it's super, super helpful when we can hear from people who have seen it at the ground level and they understand the people who are directly impacted by this. So I really appreciate you sharing this so that people can make an informed decision on whether or not it's a good idea to pass or not.
Well, Melissa, it is always a pleasure, and we'll talk soon.
I'm glad I caught you before you catch a flight. Please be safe with your travels, and we'll talk again.
You know, I'm talking about police officer wellness in Louisville tomorrow Wednesday. So maybe we'll come back and we'll talk about what that entails and some of the things at the national level that we're doing.
Yes. Let's get you on the calendar. Just go on hold, and then we'll put you on the calendar because I'll talk to you during this next commercial break. I would love to talk about officer wellness. That's fantastic. And I love that Gary's, you know, again, has such a hand in law enforcement, not just here, but across the country, doing a national conference he's flying out for tomorrow. So, yes, hold on one second, Gary. I'll come back to you and I'll get you on the schedule either later this week or early next week. We're going to go to traffic and weather right now. Again, Gary McNamara, thank you for your time, who is the Chief and Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University, former Chief of Police in Fairfield on WICC.
Fighting against injustice across Connecticut, Melissa in the Morning checks in with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
It's pretty alarming when you look at the statistics nationwide, how people are discriminated against because of their hair, because of the way their hair is. I mean, if you can believe it, that is something that exists in our nation today. And it is a big reason why only a few years ago we passed the official Crown Act. And we're going to talk about the significance and what this law is really all about. But we're also coming up on the anniversary on March 4th. And so to talk a little bit more about this, we have Jody Walker-Smith back on the show with us from the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Jody, welcome back. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing well. Thank you. How are you, Melissa?
I'm doing fine. I'm really glad that we're talking about this ahead of the anniversary. It's shocking to me, call me naive, but it's shocking to me. I feel like we discriminate over everything. I mean, even down to the hair on somebody's head. It's just wild to me. And I don't know which one's stranger, the fact that we have a discrimination issue because of hair, or the fact that it took this long knowing that there's a discrimination issue in our country. It took us that long. We only passed this in 2021. It's wild.
Right. Right.
It's a lot to unpack.
I mean,
there.
We were only the eighth state. We were only the eighth state to pass this Crown Act in that national movement. Now there's 24 states, though. So there's certainly momentum. It's
good.
Being considered in other states as well. I know Vermont is considering it right now. And so there is more attention on this issue, but you're right. It's long overdue, and it's not enough. There's actually a bill in Connecticut right now. I think there's a public hearing today, Senate Bill 178, which would make it a requirement for education and training for barbers, hairdressers, and cosmeticians to include working with textured hair in their curriculum. Because, you know, if you go to any given hair salon and the hairdressers there haven't been trained in their certifications and licenses to work with textured hair, then they essentially are turning away potentially Black clients because they don't have that experience or knowledge, which seems to fit squarely within the Crown Act.
Wait a second. Now that blows my mind. Wait a second. Hold on, Jody.
Right.
But roll back the tapes for a hot second. So this is why I love working on this show, this and many other reasons, because I get to learn stuff that I had no idea about. You mean to tell me that it is not a requirement right now for hairdressers, barbers, what have you, to know how to work with? I mean, I don't want to say it makes sense, but I guess I can believe it because, you know, you see all the time, especially depicted in media, that a lot of times, you know, people of color will go to a Black barber shop or will go like a Black owned barber shop. And I would imagine, mm-hmm. I always thought it was because, you know, kind of the same thing we see in schools. Like if people see more of others who look like them and they can relate to them. But I didn't realize it's because mm-hmm. we just don't have the curriculum in place that we're requiring all hairdressers to know how to work with different types of hair. That's crazy.
It's probably a little bit of both, but yes, exactly.
That's crazy.
And the reason why it's wild, but, you know, unless it's required, it's not happening, right? And so I know, you know, my daughter is Black biracial, and I'm white, and I go to hairdressers, and I'll say, hey, you know, do you have experience with this, you know, type of curl texture? And they'll say, no, I have someone I might be able to suggest you to go to. Now,
What do you do in that situation? I was going to say, how do you respond to that situation, Jody? I'm very curious.
Oh, it's tough. I think that one of the things that we talk about when we come on your show a lot and what we talk about in our work at the CHRO is that we have to remove the good and bad moral judgment from mm-hmm. these conversations mm-hmm. in order to make progress. Right. Because if someone feels like they're being accused of being racist, they are less likely to make changes. Right. Because they're going to feel defensive. So it's not that someone's, you know, necessarily intentionally trying to say, well, I don't want to, you know, work with Black people. Sometimes, unfortunately, that does happen. But a lot of times the stories that we hear are often about ignorance, lack of structural supports, like requirements like this. Right. So but we also have to think about our ideas of what like professionalism is. Mm. The Crown Act. You know, there were a lot of studies that were done to kind of support the start of this movement of the Crown Act. And they found that Black women are 80% more likely to alter their natural hair to accommodate social norms or work expectations.
That's ridiculous.
80%.
That's
right?
Ridiculous.
Or that people are sent home from work. Black women are sent home from work 1.5 times more likely than white women because of their hair. There's a big story in the news right now about a boy named Daryl George in Texas. Have you heard about him? He's a teenager.
No, I haven't.
He's a teenager in Texas,
okay.
And he is supposed to be a junior, and he's been suspended from school this whole school year, basically.
Why?
Because his hair doesn't comply with the school's dress code.
I'm not laughing. Braids. That is literally the biggest. That is such lunacy. I have no words for that.
It absolutely is.
You're going to deny a child education and being a member of society because of the hair on his head. That just sounds so dumb. That just sounds ridiculous. That's insane.
It really is.
Oh.
And one of the things that they said was, so that actually like a state district judge just ruled last week that the school wasn't violating the Crown Act that passed in Texas last year, because they said that the policy at the school is about the length of hair. And that is, you know, everyone has a different length of hair, and that's not race-based. But what the attorney for the family is saying, which I'll anecdotally say I agree with, is that protective styles that Black people often wear to protect their hair sometimes require length.
Mm-hmm.
They might add synthetic or human hair to braid in, or that you need a certain length in order to do these braids. And he has, you know, neat-looking braids on the top of his head. It's not hanging down. But the school said, well, if he took them out, it would be too long, so he can't go to school.
What's crazy about that is I'm just thinking about, and it's not a problem. It's perfectly fine. Sorry, I'm sitting here like trying really hard to just kind of breathe through what I'm about to say. But I think that's insane when you look at how many kids, because I was one of them. Okay, I'm white. And I remember going on like a Caribbean vacation. You get the cornrows when you come back from a Caribbean vacation. Not to mention, I always had hair that went all the way down past, you know, all the way almost to like where my thighs were. That's my hair was always very long. So those two examples, that's acceptable in school because what? Because I'm white? Like that's insane.
Mm.
That is absolutely crazy. I'm sorry.
I agree with you.
Logically, like, what? How is that a distraction? I guess that's what it is. It's not a matter of judge. Because look, I try. That is like the number one thing I try to do in this world. Because who am I to judge? I am one of the most imperfect people on this planet. So I'm not trying to judge people, but just logically, what are we talking about here? That hair is a distraction in school. That hair is what defines how good of a worker you're going to be. I mean, what would be the point of discriminating based on hair? It doesn't make any sense. It just logically makes no sense.
Right. And that's when you have to wonder, maybe it is racism, right? Because the history of Black people and hair is fraught from the days of slavery on. I mean, the braids used to be intricate maps to escape slavery. There's a long history of the importance of hair. But you know, I had an interesting experience recently that kind of touches on some of these issues, and it was a really good teaching moment. And it happened right here in Connecticut, so I thought it might be helpful to share. So we don't think that this just happens in Texas, for instance, right?
Mm, right, of course not.
So my elementary age daughter, who I mentioned is biracial and Black, was so excited about an upcoming pajama day. Pajama day is the best thing that happens to elementary school students, apparently.
Oh, for sure.
My
5-year-old will attest to that. Yes, absolutely.
Yes. So the day's drawing near, and one night at bedtime, she looks sad, and I'm like, what's going on? And she said, her teacher said that the students, who are predominantly Black, Hispanic, and multiracial in her class, are not allowed to wear bonnets on pajama day. Now, my daughter wears a silk bonnet to bed every night, like many Black women and girls.
Yeah.
It protects her hair and her hairstyle. And she said that her and her girlfriends asked her teacher, who's white, why they couldn't wear their sleeping bonnet. And the teacher, according to my daughter, said, I just don't like them. And my daughter asked me, why would she say that? Like, what is she talking about? And, you know, I talked to my daughter about it and, you know, did what I could with her. But then I spoke with the school and they handled it with a lot of thoughtful action, and they handled it promptly.
Good.
And we talked about how some white people, myself included, didn't grow up knowing about bonnets. I this is something I learned about as I grew, because
absolutely.
I didn't have one. My parents didn't introduce that to me, and I was not aware of that. So I learned about how they have real protective benefits for textured hair and the cultural significance. I mean, they maintain moisture, they keep the hair hydrated, and then also some hairstyles are really expensive and take hours and hours. I mean, my daughter just got box braids and it took 5 hours.
But in Jody,
you've got to protect it overnight.
I also think, though, Jody, there's a massive difference between not, because I agree with you. It wasn't until I made friends when I was in high school and then in college who were black and could explain to me, you know, why they, you know, that their hair routine was very different than mine. No problem. I think there's a huge difference between I didn't know versus just blatantly saying, well, I don't like it. Like what? I mean,
right,
what?
Right.
That just is absolutely insane. I think I owe the audience a little bit of an apology. I don't mean to get so worked up. And I do believe on WICC, we've made it a real point with our shows to make it an open platform, to open it up for people to share their opinions, their thoughts, all of that. And it is. This is a safe space on WICC. But sometimes when you hear about the stories happening, including right here in our own backyard, and to me, it is so simple sometimes to be a human and we complicate it so much. It's infuriating. It is not that hard to just be kind to people. It is not that hard to say if something is different for you or you don't know about it, to ask questions or to inquiry about something, but to just blatantly tell someone, I just don't like it, is so infuriating. And to block someone from an opportunity from being like everyone else in the classroom because of the way they look is never going to make sense to me. It's never, ever, ever, ever going to make sense to me. And so if I get a little worked up, it's just, that's why. So I'm just sharing that. I just think love more and judge less. Good God. We're talking with Jody Walker-Smith, who's with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. We're talking about the Crown Act, which passed in 2021 here in Connecticut, March 4th. We're coming up on the anniversary, and it stands for Creating a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair. It is a law that prohibits race-based hair discrimination, and that's denying someone employment or educational opportunities because of their hair texture. Or their hairstyles, and that includes things like your braids, locks, twists, just to name a few. Jody, talk to us about why Connecticut passed this finally and sort of the effects that we're seeing now in our state and how we're recognizing the anniversary on the 4th.
Yes, thank you, Melissa. If you wouldn't mind me just taking a quick second to close the loop, because I do want to, you know, give the school credit for the story I was telling right before the break. That they purchased and disseminated information about the Crown Act and used it as a teaching opportunity. And I think that's fantastic because that's what we need. We need to educate ourselves and each other. And I asked my daughter last night how she felt about the Crown Act, and she said, well, I recently got box braids like a lot of my friends, and I love them, and I'm glad my school protects us in being able to wear them. So, you know, this doesn't have to be, you know, like the situation in Texas where this child is being deprived of school for months on end and crying, saying he just wants to go to school. You can just, you know, take a moment, pause, reflect, and do the right thing, as you were saying. So I just wanted to close the loop on that.
Yeah, but I agree.
Well, you know, we passed this law. Actually, the CHRO was really involved in drafting the bill and getting it passed because we wanted to ensure that it wasn't just that there was a law that said, you know, you can't discriminate based on hair, because that can get confusing. And so what we did is we actually put it in within the definition of race. And so race, like in our discrimination statutes, includes these hairstyles and protective hairstyles. And so, yeah, as you said, it can apply in schools, but it could also apply in, you know, sporting events. You might have heard a number of years ago there was a boy who was forced to cut his dreadlocks off at the start of a wrestling match. You know, these are things that should not happen. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in hiring or in any employment situation, public accommodation, this is going to protect people. And it includes protective hairstyles, so wigs, head wraps, you know, any of the styles that you mentioned. And we want employers and organizations to think about, you know, are your dress codes or grooming policies or ideas of professionalism potentially outdated or centering what we think of as, you know, white ideas of what hairstyles will look like. And if those policies are having a disparate impact or, you know, impacting Black applicants and employees differently, then that might be a Crown Act violation. That might be discrimination based on race. And so we are encouraging folks to really look at their dress code and grooming policies, their handbooks, and really start to think about whether there's things that they hadn't realized that are unfairly impacting their Black applicants or clientele.
Yeah, and so if people want to learn more about the Crown Act, like you said, Jody, and I'm glad that you shared sort of the ending of how the school handled it, because I think, again, reiterating, I think it's wonderful that people learn about things, especially if it's out of their comfort zones or they didn't grow up that way, so they don't know. You don't know until you learn. I do believe very heavily in that, and I think that's fine. It's the line that gets crossed of just judging that mm-hmm. I just don't like something. That's where
yeah.
it's really a challenge for me, where I just find that we look for things sometimes to just be upset about versus just asking questions or being curious about something or just, you know, learning a little bit more, being vulnerable, if you will, which sometimes can be hard. I do understand that. But
sure.
If people wanted to learn more about this, Jody, especially employers or schools, and they wanted to, you know, mm-hmm. print content, like you were saying, the school that your daughter goes to, they did this as a learning opportunity. What would you suggest? Where do they go to get that information?
There's so much out there. I mean, the Crown Coalition has a lot of information at thecrownact.com. That was kind of the movement that started these bills. You can also check out our Facebook page at CTCHRO or Instagram at CT_CHRO. We've put out a number of educational materials on the Crown Act. You can just search our page, Crown, and you'll find those. Our diversity, equity, and inclusion social media team puts out a lot of educational material. And then there are a lot of, I mean, if we're talking about education, there's so many great books.
Mm-hmm.
We have great books in my house that I've recommended to the school about, you know, affirming racial identity and, you know, loving your hair. And there's a great book called Hair Love that is also a short film that won an Oscar. And there's many, many different resources out there.
Yeah.
Questlove made a show on Disney Plus last year that had a really cute cartoon about
yes.
girls wearing the bonnets for
mm-hmm.
a sleepover. Yeah.
Yep.
So if you look for it, it's out there.
Yeah.
You just have to take a little time to find it.
Certainly. And there's also some great resources, as Jody mentioned. If you go to like there's a website, thecrownact.com. You can find a lot there as well. And Jody, I want to thank you so much for talking about this ahead of the anniversary. And thank you for also being personal, sharing that story. I really appreciate your insight.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
Of course. Always welcome. Jody Walker-Smith of the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities here on WICC. The CDC says contagious stomach bugs, including norovirus, seem to be circulating right now and hitting the Northeast, including Connecticut, especially hard this season. The CDC says the positivity rate for norovirus, for example, which causes cramps, vomiting, diarrhea, all that great stuff, is more than 15% in the Northeast alone. What the heck is going on? We've got Dr. Andrew Wong, who is here to make some sense of this. He is the Fairfield Region Medical Director of Hartford Healthcare Primary Care. Dr. Wong, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, good morning, Melissa. Happy to be here.
Glad to
be talking about a virus other than COVID.
I know, right? Yeah, I guess it's a little bit of a break for you guys. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. But, you know, I will say, personally, in our own household, Dr. Wong, we had this issue a couple of weeks back. My son and husband both had it. My son worse than my husband. And when I started to let his class know, let the teacher know and all that, mm-hmm. she said this was mm-hmm. something that virtually the entire class has had at mm-hmm. some point or another in the last few weeks. And it is very, very contagious. What's going on?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So the rates last year, in fact, in 2023, in March, were the highest ever recorded. But it looks like this year we're right on track to probably beat that. About 15% of tests come out positive for norovirus. And I think there's a good correlation that currently, at any one time in the Northeast, about 15% of all of us have norovirus in our system. And I think that number is going to beat last year's record high of about 16%. It's a combination of the fact that norovirus is highly contagious, so you just need a few particles of the virus to catch it. And it's also very resistant. So the hand sanitizers generally don't do a good job of eradicating norovirus. It's soap and water that's really the only way of killing the virus from our hands.
Wait, that's so interesting, because I feel like since 2020, everything has been hand sanitizer. Why is just the classic soap and water more effective?
Mm-hmm. There's certain viruses that have a very tough protein capsule that protects itself, which is usually pretty different from cold viruses, also flu viruses. So coronavirus, we know hand sanitizer is very effective in destroying it, as well as flu. But these bugs that tend to hang out in the stomach, things like enterovirus, Coxsackie virus, and then now this really contagious norovirus, they are more resistant. So I think that some of the habits that we've learned, which are generally good, keep your hands sanitized frequently, it's not effective for noro. So especially for food preparers or for people who are about to eat, you have to use soap and water for 20 seconds before we do that.
And again, we have Dr. Andrew Wong here, one of our regulars who comes on the show, talks about what we're seeing in the medical field and certainly right here in Connecticut. He is actually the Fairfield Region Medical Director of Hartford Healthcare Primary Care with an office right here in Westport. We'll give you all his details after we're done chatting. But we're talking about this very contagious stomach bug. Do we typically see this every year, though, Dr. Wong? Like, is this, it seems, I know stomach bug is not like a new virus of any sorts, but, you know, mm-hmm. is this worse than it usually is, or are we kind of on track for what we typically see in February?
Yeah, the peak season for norovirus is fall, winter, and spring, and that's when we all tend to congregate indoors into small spaces, and that's why we tend to see outbreaks in daycares, elementary schools. So there was an elementary school in New Jersey that actually had to close because of norovirus for about 3 to 5 days so that they could deep clean everything. But why are the rates hitting record highs this year? I think we're going to have a record high last year. 16-17% was the highest rate on record. It's probably a combination of a few things. I think number one is that it's resistant. So I think we've gotten very comfortable with hand sanitizer, but knowing that you need soap and water to kill this virus, maybe we're not doing enough there. But then I think the other question is that we've kind of gotten rid of these quarantining protocols, the unmaskings, people coming back together in groups. Maybe people getting a little bit more lackadaisical about the basic things. I know with our son, we used to stand there and watch him wash his hands, soap, water, count to 20 seconds, sing the alphabet song. And now I have to admit, we're a little bit more kind of like, okay, you wash your hands and he runs away. And it's like, oh, okay, fine, we'll let him do that. So there's a little bit of maybe being a little bit more lackadaisical about keeping up our sanitary standards. There's also the fact that a lot of us have had this kind of travel bug that we haven't traveled in many years, and now we're going on cruises and flights, eating out more, and those are the places typically where the virus spreads.
So it seems like, Dr. Wong, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like what you're suggesting people to do is to kind of go back to, there wasn't a lot of great that came out of COVID. But one thing is for sure is that we practice much better hygiene because we were so fearful of getting COVID. And so going back to those basics, washing your hands for 20 seconds, making sure, you know, you and I have talked about this before. I know that you're saying hand sanitizer is not as effective as washing your hands. But when you use a shared space, for example, when you have a kitchen counter or you live, you work in an office space where you share it with somebody else, you know, maybe sanitizing that. It sounds like you're saying go back to the basics to give yourself a better shot at avoiding this.
Yeah. We want to be very conscientious of, especially when we're putting food into our mouths, we want to make sure that if we have these symptoms, that we're not preparing food. So if we have a stomach ache, maybe some muscle aches, you don't want to be preparing foods, or at the very least, wash your hands thoroughly so we don't spread it to other people, because it is very contagious. You may want to, if you're traveling especially, go for foods that are definitely cooked. So maybe avoid the salads. Also, shellfish can have high concentrations of norovirus. So there have been outbreaks related to shellfish, sushi as well. So maybe avoid the raw foods, uncooked foods, especially if you're traveling. And maybe places where sanitation may be limited. So think street vendors in busy cities, things like that. Maybe try to avoid eating those types of foods when we're traveling.
Mm. Yeah, those are some really great tips. And Dr. Wong, are there other viruses or other things that you are personally seeing in your practice or in recent weeks?
Yeah, it's interesting. Influenza is coming back. And it's funny, there's an influenza A going around that's causing more like a chronic sort of cough. Mm-hmm. So rather than this kind of like 72-hour thing that comes and goes, we're seeing more people with these kind of, you know, long-term bugs that patients are saying, hey, I've been sick since December and now it's February. I've been coughing. I've had some drainage and general soreness. It's really unusual. I think that we had kind of almost a reprieve from these common colds and flus and stomach bugs during the pandemic, that we had such good quarantining measures in place that, in fact, those helped us from getting other viruses as well. And it's almost like our immune systems maybe took a little siesta, a little break. So now that we're getting re-exposed to these germs, we're getting affected in different ways. And I think the patterns are a little bit different. So, you know, after everything that we've done through the pandemic, it would be good to come away with a positive lesson. Making sure that we're washing our hands thoroughly, maybe staying home when we're sick. And if we're going into crowded spaces, you know, A, making sure that we're not sick ourselves when we go into group settings, but even maybe wear a mask whenever you can if you're shopping or going into public spaces.
Yeah, some really, really great tips. And again, Dr. Andrew Wong, want to thank you so much. If people want to contact your office, make an appointment, where do they go?
Yes, we're in Westport. We have a lot of great doctors here. We also have doctors who are available for same-day appointments in Fairfield, Bridgeport, Milford, Stratford, all over Fairfield County. So just give us a call, 203-221-3830.
Dr. Wong, always appreciate you. Thank you so much for all this great information, and we will talk again soon.
My pleasure. Have a great day, Melissa.
Thanks, you too. Dr. Andrew Wong, again, who is a Fairfield Region Medical Director of Hartford Healthcare Primary Care, right here on WICC.